Okay, so far this weekend, I assume most of you will have heard really inspiring sessions. Sessions that uncover the barbarism of capitalism. Sessions that uncover the real workings of this world. So we've gone from, you know, to begin with, an analysis of how the international capitalist system is destroying millions of people's lives. We've heard from Zodwa and Trevor about the situation in South Africa, the fact that apartheid's gone, yet poverty, inequality and capitalism remain. We've heard about war, we've heard about racism, oppression, all of these things. Now, this talk isn't going to be about those things specifically. I have to assume that most people here are convinced that they're against capitalism. I have to assume that most people here are convinced that they're on the side of the working class. And most people here are convinced that, you know, a revolution is at least a really good idea and that it's got to be better than the way the system works at the moment. Rather, this talk is going to be an argument for socialist organisation. And the main contention that I want to keep coming back to in this talk is that for a revolution to be successful, there needs to be a massive socialist organisation with revolutionary politics. Now, short of a socialist revolution, socialist parties are very important. You know, I'd argue that they're the best fighters for reforms and that reforms can pave the way for revolution. But this won't be my focus. So anyway, before I go on to the specific type of organisation that revolutionary socialists support, I figured I should make some general arguments for organisation overall. Individualist politics don't work. So, you know, there have been rare individuals, inspired individuals, who have, through their own efforts, made a real impact upon the world. But if you think about it, none of this change has been effected without some sort of organisation, without some sort of mass support base. So the most obvious example is that of Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. They first of all organised into the Communist League in Germany, later on into the First International. And really, their ideas have only had an impact. Marx was quite obscure during his lifetime. Their ideas have only had an impact because millions and millions of workers around the world have been inspired by them. So anyway, assuming that no one here is the next Karl Marx or Engels or whatever, even sort of more moderate, small-scale individualism is flawed. And this is not just because we're more effective in numbers. We are more effective in numbers, that's true. But I think there's a more inescapable reason why small-scale action and individualism is a flawed way of changing the world overall. And that's because the ruling class is thoroughly organised. If you take the example of war, I think that's the most immediate example. It's highly technological, it's highly organised, mass slaughter. So at the moment, the main war in the Middle East, this is killing thousands and thousands of people, and this requires an incredible degree of organisation from the ruling class. But similarly, the ruling class is in the possession of a huge apparatus that it uses to keep people down back on the home front. So there's an example of this that I heard about a few days ago, which I thought spelled it out quite well. I was talking with a friend from Switzerland, and when he was back there over the break, he went to a protest against the World Economic Forum. Now, also at the World Economic Forum was a guy called Henry Kissinger, who is a real work of art, this guy. He is a blight upon humanity. Like, he has been a foreign policy advisor to Nixon, to President Ford. He was masterminded some of the atrocities seen in the Vietnam War. He's been part of the overthrow of dozens of democratically elected governments around the world. So this man is a criminal. Who got arrested at the demonstration, do you reckon? It wasn't Kissinger. It was my friend and the other 100 or so protesters that were there trying to raise awareness about this issue. And so this is basically to say that the ruling class is pretty self-aware and pretty organised, more than we are at most times. And we can't just wish this away by closing our eyes to it. That's just wishful thinking. Similarly, I think it's quite utopian to imagine that we'll be able to just convince the rulers to give up on their massive empire, on their, give up on basically what is an economic interest in keeping us down. So for real thoroughgoing historical change to happen, I think it's pretty inescapable that we need to organise ourselves to such an extent that we can oppose the organisation of the ruling class. And this could seem a little intimidating at first. But it does help to remember that we've got the numbers, for one, but secondly, that the system relies on the labour of the working class. And so this is the power that needs to be harnessed in any organisation. And I think unions are an excellent illustration of this point. Only through massive collective action has the working class ever won anything. You know, if you think about the rights that people take for granted, the 8-hour day, sick pay, you know, all of these kinds of things, leave loading, all of this has been gotten through the collective organisation of the working class. But that's not specifically socialist. You know, these arguments that I've just made, they apply to trade unions, protest groups, reformist organisations, all sorts of different organisations. The fact is, and this is what I'm arguing for, we're for more than just organisation. We're for a specific type of organisation, socialist organisation. And I think that there are three broadly interrelated positions that should be the basis for this organisation. First of all, we're for the working class's self-emancipation. This is to say, we're not for some inspired leader coming down from heaven or Canberra to just lead us to a better world. An American socialist put it quite well when he said, if a great leader could lead people to socialism, then she could lead them back too. We're for the mass of workers standing up for themselves and saying, yes, we can run the world ourselves. And if you think about it, I would argue this is the only non-elitist view of change. It pretty much rules out some sort of parliamentary road or the guerrilla struggle or anything like that. And, of course, it means that we support workers' struggles without qualification, without questions, without any of that. And so I think that that flows nicely into my second point that I think is necessary for socialist organising. We are for revolution. We're for the replacement of the present state with a democratically run worker state. The present state that we live in, or the state in the United States, they are too drenched with blood. They are too steeped in oppression to ever be made into tools for the working class to, you know, take control of themselves. You know, really, I think seeing the state as something that we can just capture is like thinking that you can use a nuclear bomb to rebuild a city. It just doesn't work out. So this is why we're for destroying the state and putting a workers' state, a democratic state, in its place. And finally, the last point I think is central, is that we have to support the oppressed. That in order to end capitalist exploitation, the working class needs as much unity as is possible. This means overcoming really central divides that capitalism promotes, national divides, racial divides, all of these types of things. Similarly, we'll have to enlist the support of specifically oppressed parts of the population, such as women, gays, racial, religious minorities, all of these kinds of things. Now, you know, people can probably add dozens of equally important, you know, political points that add to these ones. But I suppose I'd argue that further points, you know, such what attitude you take towards the USSR or questions like that, they sort of flow on from those first three. And at any rate, I don't think it's a hard and fast list. I just think it's the basis for a discussion. And so I have to assume that most people here agree with some of that stuff. I don't have all the time in the world to make a detailed argument in favour of each one of those things. Rather, I want to consider why we need to organise around specific revolutionary politics, those three points. And to that, I would answer, we need to organise around this set of politics, this somewhat limited set of views, precisely because only a minority of people in the world accept these views. Now, this can seem a bit of a contradiction. After all, we are only for a revolution if it involves the mass majority of the working class. And, of course, a revolution, I would argue, is in the interests of the working class. So, I suppose the first thing to explain is why do only a minority of people in the world agree with revolutionary politics? Firstly, the ruling class consciously spreads ideas that criticise not just the revolution, but any project for social change. And, you know, I'm just choosing one, there are many, but how often do you hear the argument, and like, I was having this argument with people, you know, yesterday, I've had it dozens of times in my career as a socialist, that the problem is human nature. That if there were any revolutionary change in society, any large sweep, this would be undermined by just a few rotten apples. And basically class society would be reimposed. I think this is what is taught at school. This is what passes for historical analysis in most uni subjects. And the implication is that, really, class society is to some extent natural and certainly inevitable. Now, I just don't think this argument stands up to interrogation. I just don't think there's a lot of evidence for it. I mean, you know, imagine this massive revolution involving hundreds of thousands of workers. You have demonstrations, you have strikes, general strikes. You've got workers' councils. You know, you've got a real sort of situation of revolutionary proportions. And then at the end of it all, someone gets up and says, hey guys, I know what, I should own everything. And what do you reckon? I don't reckon people are going to go down with it. You know, I don't reckon that's particularly plausible. But nonetheless, that's one particular idea that does get a lot of sort of support. It's promoted a lot by institutions, the education institution, the media, all of this kind of thing. I think there are more ideas like that. I think racism works in a relatively similar way in order to convince people that the main enemy is someone with different coloured skin or a different religion or whatever. Similarly, I think that's a bourgeois idea. Now, to resist the pressure of these kinds of ideas, because I think they're everywhere, they permeate every part of society, this is the first reason why we need to organise around clear politics that really explain the world. This is the only way that we can make sure that our viewpoints remain as independent as possible from some of the ideology that justifies the system. We can reinforce ourselves through discussion, through analysis, that takes opposing capitalism as its starting point. And so, in this sense, a revolutionary party has been called before the memory of the working class. That is to say, we've got a duty to keep revolutionary thinking going, even when it only represents a minority current in society. simply because if we didn't, we would lose decades and decades of work. We would lose some of the best work of people like Marx, like Lenin, like Trotsky. We'd have to reinvent the wheel every time workers started to struggle again. So in that sense, that's the first reason that all socialist organisation has to play the role of the memory of the working class. Now, since I'm talking about ruling class ideology, I don't think it's just the most right-wing stuff either. It's not just the most brazen, out there, nutty ideas that, you know, everyone here is against racism. You know, no one thinks racism's a good idea. But reformism, the idea that change, that we can end capitalism, or at least ameliorate the worst of capitalism via parliament, this is one that's quite prominent, but similarly, I think it's an idea without much historical evidence for it. Labour governments in this country, just to use this country as an example, have a pretty dirty record of fighting imperialist wars. You know, Labour governments fought World War I, II and the Gulf War. Ben Chifley, famous Labour Prime Minister, introduced ASIO, which then went on to spy on anti-war activists during the Vietnam War. Labour governments have used racism. They supported the White Australia policy until the 60s. They've attacked workers' rights. The Hawke Labour government presided over the largest decline in union membership that this country has seen and that paved the way for some of John Howard's attacks. So then why do hundreds of thousands of workers agree with this kind of what we'd call reformist political project? Well, the answer is not just that they've been brainwashed by the media. You know, obviously the media does promote this stuff, but it's pretty clear that on heaps of issues, people are able to see through the media. People believe reformist ideas because they fit well with people's lived experience. This is to say, for most of our lives, we have pretty much zero influence over the political process. People are systematically disempowered at every level of life. Furthermore, the institutions of the state which exist are invested with this sense of permanence, this sense of superiority, this sense of indestructibility. You know, like the idea that surely a high court judge in a wig, you know, knows far more than some ordinary person who hasn't done years and years in the legal system, whatever. This is one that's, you know, consciously reinforced by the system. Similarly, the kind of democratic, ground-up institutions that I would argue for, you know, workers' councils, revolution and that, this is pretty far from most people's lived experience. Most people haven't lived to see this. So in that sense, capitalism creates ideas which are convincing because of the lived reality of this system. And these ideas can then reinforce the system. Now, it is possible to overcome these ideas in mass numbers. There's a lot of historical evidence for that, and I'll be going into an example of that a bit later on. But for a moment, what we need to keep in mind is that these ideas are convincing to a lot of people. Despite this, however, ideas in the system are uneven. In most capitalist societies, there is a minority who is able to see through all the crap that we're taught by the bosses and by the media. And often this minority is a particularly radical or militant section of the working class that have sort of gained that insight through their own struggles or through a history of that kind of thing. Marxists tend to call this minority the vanguard of the working class. And for people that are more interested on that subject, there's a session later on that deals with that concept entirely. So this is to say that the vanguard, the conscious minority in the working class, can point the way forward to other workers who have more conservative, less left-wing ideas. These revolutionary workers, you know, you could say that they're conscious of their class interests. This is to say that they can see the logical endpoint of the class struggle has got to be ending capitalism. So this means that for the militant revolutionary minority to really convince all of the other people in society, all the massive other workers that believe different things, that they've got to be quite clear themselves, organisationally, that they are revolutionaries. I think any blurring of the lines on this one interferes with the message. You know, you can't really convince people of what is basically a whole different worldview if you're all just a bit vague and a bit self-contradictory and a bit unsure about it yourself. So anyway, this brings me back to my earlier contention. Revolutionaries have to organise as revolutionaries precisely because, for the most part, under capitalism, our ideas are in a minority. And just as a point of clarification, Socialist Alternative is not the vanguard of the working class. We'd like to organise the vanguard of the working class. But again, for more on the distinction, there's a session later on. Now, I think this fact, the fact that reformist ideas can predominate in society, is an argument against a party that tries to combine reform and revolution. Because reformist ideas are so pervasive, they've got so much support from the state institutions that exist, I think that reformism will always dominate such a combined party. Revolutionaries will be effectively marginalised. You know, I think the history of parties that try and combine revolutionaries with reformists is a pretty dismal one, and one of two things can happen. Either the revolutionaries stop being revolutionaries or they're kicked out of the party in reasonably short order. So the most important reason, I think, for revolutionaries to organise separately is that in this way we can take actions that contradict reformist goals without being tied down by a party with more conservative ideas. So that is to say, revolutionary workers, organised independently, could go on strike against a Labor government without having to worry about the others in the party that might not agree with that. Indeed, I think that now that we have a Labor government, federally speaking, this is all the more important. And it's only natural, really, that people that are committed to Laborism will be less inclined to go on strike against Labor governments. And in this way, revolutionaries can take actions which demonstrate to other workers who are starting to question their own presuppositions. This way, revolutionaries can take actions which prove the superiority of revolutionary ideas. So that's the second reason, I think, why revolutionaries need to organise separately. Now, there's another bit of a contradiction in this. I'm arguing for a socialist party to organise and to lead the working class, and yet I think that the working class has the ability to liberate itself. So I think the first thing to say is that a socialist organisation is not some superior thing, or shouldn't be some superior thing towering over the working class. Instead, it should be part of the class, embedded deeply into that class, and in dialogue with other parts of the class. But this doesn't fully answer the question. You know, the other thing that I'm not arguing for, socialists aren't just for educating people until eventually there's 51% of Australia socialist and then we just introduce socialism. I don't think that that's a vision for a future, because in that sense, it's the Socialist Party making the revolution. And if you remember back to those three points, I'm for the working class making the revolution. So I suppose to explain this in Marxist terms, we think, and I think there's a lot of historical evidence for this, that the working class can become class conscious without the help of some external force. And this can occur in often contradictory ways. You know, it can start out with a fight for just basic rights. It can start out with, you know, what you might term more of an economic fight for a wage gain or against a particular cut. And involved in this kind of fight, this kind of class struggle, there'll be heaps of different workers with all sorts of different ideas in their head. You know, there'll be some more left-wing ones, there'll be some more right-wing ones, and within the head of any one particular person, there'll probably be all sorts of different ideas, most of which contradict each other, and it's not particularly systematised. Nonetheless, when workers go into struggle, they're proving in practice the validity of socialist ideas. You know, when workers start to create workers' councils, when they go on general strike, when we're dealing with a really revolutionary situation, this is when, in spite, at times, of the ideas in their heads, the working class proves the viability of socialism. They prove that capitalism is a doomed system. And so, in this sense, these struggles can create an enormous radicalisation and a real opening for revolutionary thinking in key sections of the working class. And really, these struggles can take workers by surprise. So, that said, there are limits to this process. You know, what I've argued is that massive struggles can erupt, that people can become quite open to very revolutionary ways of thinking. This can occur for the whole working class, really, or the majority of it at any rate. But this, by itself, is not enough. Workers who've only just started to open up their eyes to politics, there's no guarantee. You know, they might hate capitalism, they might, you know, sincerely want a revolution, but there's no guarantee that they'll know what is actually involved in this. They'll have the kind of clarity and the kind of comprehensive view of politics that only comes with sort of a bit more experience. A minority might, but really, in most of these radicalisations, it can be quite uneven. So in that sense, when you get a mass radicalisation, there's a real battle of ideas that goes on. You know, in revolutionary situations, reformists, they talk left, they talk about socialism. You know, they talk about, like, you know, we had the example of the ANC, you know, talking about bringing in socialism, the African National Congress, that is, in South Africa, bringing in socialism. Similarly, workers could be won over by some variety of anarchist ideas, some sort of dead-end project that isn't going to actually challenge the system. In this kind of situation, revolutionaries have a responsibility to put their ideas front and centre and to try and win over as many people that have just started to question the whole way the system works. Not doing this could mean the defeat of a revolution. So that means we've got to be prepared beforehand to fight and to defend our positions. And so it's not just that we do this because we'd like there to be a majority of revolutionaries in society. That'd be pretty cool, but that's not the end point. The end point, and I think this is the most profound and the most sort of history-making part of revolutionary politics, is sort of uniting that revolutionary theory with the actual practice of revolution. This means organising a revolution. And so this is to say, once you've won a majority of workers, once a majority of workers have become convinced of the need for a revolution in society, there comes the question of the actual insurrection. And this is the final reason that I would go over why you need a socialist organisation. You know, a revolution by its nature can be quite a tactical affair. You know, which government buildings do you take over? Like, how do you make sure they don't, you know, bomb the bridges across the Yarra? These kinds of questions. And in this sense, you could well have, there are plenty of historical examples where revolutionary forces have been a majority in society, yet because of their disorganisation, there's nothing to prevent the ruling class slowly isolating them, picking them off, demoralising them, all of this kind of thing, and thereby diffusing the situation. So the final argument for a socialist organisation is that in the heat of revolution, we'll need to make quick decisions, we'll need real leadership, and only really an organisation can provide this. Now, we've had quite a few sessions this weekend that have dealt with Russia, so I'm not going to focus on Russia. I think Russia is an example of this working out. So people might want to bring it up in the discussion. Rather, I want to use an example that hasn't been, maybe it has been talked about so far, but it's more recent, and I think it proves in spades what I'm talking about. And this is the example of Chile. In 1970, a moderate reformer by the name of Salvador Allende got elected. And this was part of a somewhat shaky coalition with a few other more conservative people, Christian Democrats in particular. Now, Allende himself was a purebred reformist. You know, he claimed to be working towards a Chilean form of socialism. But really, you know, for him, this just meant legislation. And when he took power, he guaranteed that he wouldn't touch the army and that he wouldn't touch the democratic, supposedly, parliamentary system. His socialism really just introduced a few Keynesian economic measures. And this largely left the fortunes of the wealthy elite in Chile untouched. Even when he did nationalise some industries, he never did that for many, and it was always with very hefty compensation to the ex-rulers. In some cases, in the copper industry in particular, the ruling class came out of it on top. They actually made more money out of Allende than they lost. But nonetheless, Allende's election and his rhetoric raised the hopes of the working class and therefore created a wave of class struggles. When Allende spoke of socialism, he didn't really mean it, but the mass of workers weren't really to know that. So, you know, he didn't mean to challenge the ruling class or the state, but the mass of workers did. So they took from his ideas inspiration to go and fight. Just to give you an example, a wave of strikes that overtook the country resulted in a wage rise of 38% for manual workers and of 120% for white-collar workers. And this was just in the space of a few years. Now, and similarly, peasants in the countryside, they took his rhetoric seriously. They started just saying, oh, well, you know, Allende's going to give us the land. He wasn't really. Allende's going to give us the land, so we'll just cut forward and we'll take it ourselves. So land seizures became quite commonplace in the countryside. And this, you know, and of course factories were occupied. Hundreds and hundreds of factories were occupied. This created a massive political crisis for the regime because the ruling class thought that this was just a load of shit. The ruling class wasn't willing to take this. Now, Allende pretty much agreed with the ruling class. His priority as a reformist was to strengthen the state. His whole orientation was to the capitalist state and maintaining power in that. So even when he got up in front of stadiums, and if people haven't seen the videos of this, you should find them on YouTube or something, speaking to hundreds of thousands of people about socialism, like we're talking bigger than the MCG here, hundreds of thousands of people to socialism, while he was doing this, he was using the civil guards, I've forgotten their actual name, I think it's the Fuerzas Móviles, the mobile forces, who he'd promised to disband in 1970, who had a record of brutality. So while he was talking about socialism, these civil guards were beating up people and torturing people. Despite this, however, workers set up workers' councils, and these were called the cordones in Spanish. The cordones, they organised workers on the basis of their workplaces. They coordinated local strike action, local marches, but they were also defensive. So, for instance, when the right in Chile tried to organise, you know, essentially the upper middle class, and in particular lorry drivers to organise a blockade of the major cities, because Chile is a very long country, so it, you know, relies on roads quite a bit. When the right tried to organise these forces, the cordones, the workers' councils, successfully organised around this, which just shows how much of the working class they organised and how much support they had. They were able to basically circumvent this, and so the Chilean economy kept going, despite the attempted sabotage by the right. And so the bourgeoisie at this point are quite furious about losing control of their system. Now, they did things like they deliberately sabotaged the economy. They hoarded goods to send the prices artificially up. And while this was happening, Allende was busy inviting generals from the army into his cabinet. Now, one cordon, this is actually not just a cordon, this is one that represented the councils of 600 factories. So that's tens of thousands of workers right there, if not hundreds of thousands. The response of one of these cordones was to say this: what we want is revolution. We don't want reform. We want people's power once and for all in Chile. We don't want generals in the new cabinet because we think they want to stop the revolution. And really, they didn't just think that. They had evidence that the generals were against the revolution. Soldiers and sailors in the army who were sympathetic to the revolutionary process had told them so. It was quite open. The right-wing press were calling for a counter-revolution. And so how does this all relate to the question of a socialist party? To look at the Chilean left in 1972, there are a few groupings. The first one was the Communist Party. They were Stalinists. They looked to the USSR. So let's leave them aside. They're not particularly cool. The second was the Socialist Party. This was Allende's party. But nonetheless, the Socialist Party had a very strong left wing. It had a left wing that involved many people who were revolutionaries. To give you a sense, this is a resolution they passed in 1967. The Socialist Party declares the taking of power as the strategic goal to be achieved by this generation to establish a revolutionary state which will liberate Chile and begin the construction of socialism. Only by destroying the bureaucratic and military apparatus of the bourgeois state can the socialist revolution be consolidated. Now, that really wouldn't sound out of place at one of the sessions this weekend. This was coming from the left of the Socialist Party. And obviously, it massively contrasted with Allende's rhetoric. And he went on somewhat naively about stressing the loyalty of the armed forces. And in that sense, the Socialist Party in 1972 was making arguments that made sense to rank-and-file workers. They gained enormous popularity. They were the only party that appeared to be willing to actually overthrow the government, that is, the left of the Socialist Party. And as a result of this, they won majorities in most of the cordones, most of the councils. They commanded a real working-class following in Chile. Well, what can we draw from all of this so far? Well, for one, in Chile, the bulk of the working class clearly did become revolutionary as a result of their own struggles. They clearly did learn that they needed to overthrow the capitalist state. Out of this process, tens of thousands of class-conscious workers made a decision. That's important. They decided to join the Socialist Party and to follow its lead. But there was a fatal flaw in the Socialist Party, and that was that even though it spoke against reformism, it was part of a party that was basically reformist. It was part of the party of Salvador Allende and government. And so while the economy was paralysed by the actions of the ruling class, Allende invited General Pinochet, the man who was to lead the coup, into government. And the tragedy of all of this is that millions of Chilean workers could clearly see that a revolution and workers' power was needed to stop the coup, and yet despite this, no party existed to lead them. The Socialist Party spoke about revolution, but when it came down to it, they refused to split. They refused to actually independently lead revolution. And so this is what allowed Pinochet to seize power in 1973, and he killed literally tens of thousands of people. Now, to give you a sense of the militancy of the working class, one worker militant later provided an anecdote that sort of explains the sense of it. And he wrote, "When we got to the factory on the morning of September 11th, 1973, it was already occupied by the workers. They gave out guns and showed us how to use them. The most disturbing factor, though, was the lack of any specific plan, any direction, and especially the lack of contact and coordination with other places where there was resistance." So Allende himself died in this coup that he'd helped to prepare. And I think that this situation makes it quite clear that if there had been a revolutionary organisation, or if the left of the Socialist Party had been led to split out of it, there could have led a real struggle for socialism, which would, at any rate, have stood a very good chance of thwarting the plans of a bloodthirsty dictator. So anyway, just to conclude, I think the lessons of Chile apply in full force to today. Workers' struggle will never die so long as capitalism exists. The reformist mode will never work. Revolution is vital if we want to see a better world. What I hope to have convinced you of is that if you want to see a victorious revolution, if you want to see the beginnings of a transformation towards a human world, we need more than just our own enthusiasm or more than just political belief. We need organisation. This is for four reasons. We have to organise to oppose the violence of those that rule. Revolutionary ideas are a minority in society. While they are, we have to defend them. When an audience opens up that can be convinced of revolutionary ideas, when it's possible to win a revolutionary majority in society, we have to be there to prove the superiority of revolutionary ideas, both in theory and in practice. And if we're able to do this, this is the best guarantee that we've got, that we will be able to actually lead a revolution that ends capitalism. So if I convince you of these points, I hope you'll commit to us in the project for building this organisation. We're not there yet, but through our combined efforts, we can lay the foundations for it. Thank you.